Hello, I'm Donovan Bigelow, and today I'm going to lecture on the Oedipus complex. There is no issue in all of Freudian metapsychology that has caused more trouble, been the focus of more intense criticism than his ideas about the Oedipus complex. I'm going to try to walk through the specifics of what he said, why he said it, what evidence he based his conclusions on, and we'll see where we end up at the end. The first thing that I want to quote is his own summary of the Oedipus complex and its position in his thinking. In a footnote added in 1920 to the 1905 publication, Three Essays on Sexuality, Freud said, "It has justly been said that the Oedipus complex is the nuclear complex of the neuroses and constitutes the essential part of their content. It represents the peak of infantile sexuality, which, through its after effects, exercises a decisive influence on the sexuality of adults. Every new arrival on this planet is faced by the task of mastering the Oedipus complex. Anyone who fails to do so falls a victim to neurosis. With the progress of psychoanalytic studies, the importance of the Oedipus complex has become more and more clearly evident. Its recognition has become the shibboleth that distinguishes the adherents of psychoanalysis from its opponents." End quote. That last line, the shibboleth, that's an Old Testament reference to a test that decided whether one tribe, where an individual was an ally or an enemy of a particular tribe. It's basically has become a metaphor for a test. Freud is saying here that the Oedipus complex and its derivatives are the decisive test of what psychoanalysis and its practitioners represent. He throws a challenge out to his critics and declares that the Oedipus complex is the center of his metapsychology, indeed the center of all human development. He does consider it a biologically based, transhistorical, cross-cultural inevitability that every human everywhere is subject to and must deal with if he or she is going to become a healthy, functioning member of any society. This is not culturally limited. Even more, if that's possible, he also held it to be the center of any discussion of broader cultural development, of morality, of religion. This is a weighty matter of the first order quite clearly. But I need to digress just a little. I have always felt that Freud's writings were a bit like a detective novel or a mystery series. And the Oedipus complex is probably the key example of that. There is nowhere in his writings, despite it being so central to all of his thinking, despite it being the test that distinguishes psychoanalysts from other ways of thinking about the human mind, he never laid out a single definitive final treatise on the subject. In order to find out what he meant about it, you have to go throughout the entire corpus of his writing. 40 plus years. He was writing about it at the very end of his life, 1938. He was writing about it in letters to his correspondent Fleece in the 1890s. And throughout his writings, he goes back. He'll write something, for example, 1905, Three Essays on Sexuality. It underwent six major revisions, six republications, with significant theoretical innovations, often involving new formulations of the Oedipus complex. Well, you can't, and if you look at the index, volume 23 of Freud's complete works, you find almost an entire page of references to the Oedipus complex. It is truly a mystery. It is truly a bit of a detective novel to go back and piece together not just what he said at any one given time, but you have to actually look in the footnotes, in the changes edition to edition. If you're reading a 1905 version, when was it changed last, versus a summary written in the 1930s, which incorporated some of these changes and yet might have had innovations in and of itself. It's an astonishing bit of literary history that he never got around to consolidating a clear statement. So my job here is to sort out extract all of Freud's primary commentaries on the Oedipus complex. I will attempt to contextualize them, summarize them. I will read the key ones. I know pedagogically that's not the most exciting, interesting thing, but on the subject this important, I have to get it right, and the only way to get it right is to quote Freud directly, I think. I want to back up a little bit and give a little history. In 1905, Freud wrote a case write-up, his first major case write-up. It's become known as the case of Dora. It involved psychosexual development, infantile sexuality, a radical idea that Freud had laid down initially in his three essays on sexuality, and he was using this case perhaps to explain what he meant, to try to justify it, perhaps try to show the clinical evidence for his conclusions. Well, he had already gotten so much blistering criticism about three essays on sexuality and the whole idea that children can have any sexual thoughts, feelings, or behaviors at all, which of course turns out to be absolutely true, but at the time was an outrage. So he writes up this case, 115 pages, of a case where he realized that he'd made a terrible mistake, a terrible omission. It was the case involving his discovery of the transference. And he realized that and published the case and highlighted this new discovery that his error had evoked in him. And as an introductory couple of pages to this case, he says the following. "And anyone who has hitherto been unwilling to believe that a psychosexual etiology, that means cause, holds good generally and without exception for hysteria, is scarcely likely to be convinced of the fact by taking stock of a single case history." This is the key part. "He would do better to suspend his judgment until his own work has earned him a right to a conviction." And I think that challenge is still appropriate today. What he's saying is, you can't take me out of context. You can't cherry pick one quote in the context of a 40-year history of research. You have to look at it in its totality. You have to not only do that, he's suggesting that valid criticism, and there's plenty of valid criticism that Freud leveled against himself as he moved forward and developed more sophisticated clinical understandings of what he was talking about and what he was seeing. No one criticized Freud more than Freud himself did, as he learned through subsequent clinical experience. But he is suggesting here, in a direct challenge, I think, he was quite pointed about that you have to do your own work before you have a right to a conviction. Quite a challenge, I think. Now, I think the question for me is, have I done my work? Have I legitimately spent enough time as a clinician to see these things unfold in front of me clinically? Have I researched him enough? We'll see. I hope so. I think I have. I am open to as much criticism as Freud is, certainly. One thing in addition, the difference is Freud has permeated our culture and even our language. We are all Freudians now, whether we like that or not. If anyone says, "Oh, she's so in denial," we all know what that means. If someone says, "Oh, he's got mommy issues or daddy issues," we all know what that means, more or less. Well, those are all Freudian ideas, directly derivative of his ideas on the Oedipus complex. And so it's hard to criticize Freud when we're in fact standing on his shoulders. And I refer to the quote that Sir Isaac Newton is alleged to have said when someone said how smart he was or what a genius he was, and he said, "If I have stood on the shoulders, if I have seen farther than others, it is because I have stood on the shoulders of giants." I think it's fair to say that we all now, as a cultural matter, are standing on Freud's shoulders. Even if we're looking down on him and criticizing him, I don't think we would have the perspective we have if it wasn't for his work. So he is not above criticism, and he doesn't need me to defend him. And that's my point today. I am not here to defend Freud. He doesn't need me to defend him. He's a world historical genius. We will be reading his writings in 1,000 years. Of that, I have not the slightest doubt. His critics don't need me to defend them. They don't need me to refute them or support them. All I'm doing today, as sincerely as I can, having done my work, is I'm simply trying to determine as clearly as I possibly can exactly what Freud meant by the Oedipus complex. How did it develop? What was going on? What are the differences between boys and girls? How is it resolved? What are the effects of its resolution? What are the effects of its lack of resolution or derailment? So that's all I'm trying to do. I'm just trying to understand what he said about the Oedipus complex. If I can do that, then my purpose is solved for today. I hope it will be well worth the effort. However, I think it's essential, because I'm going to be throwing around a lot of technical terms, I would advise any listener who has not yet had an introduction to the basic concepts of Freud to go back and listen to Freud and Introduction, Lecture 1 and 2 in this lecture series. But let me at least highlight the things that I think are critical for an understanding of the Oedipus complex. First of all, the difference between psychic reality and external reality. Freud was clear about this. He actually said that psychic reality is more powerful than external reality, that our unconscious, the derivatives of our unconscious, laid down from birth on, possibly even prenatally, have built up in us the repository of all of our repressions. I don't think too many people doubt the existence of an unconscious process in all of us. There's too much evidence of that. Above and beyond dreams, which seem to be clear proof of an unconscious in all of us. But the idea is that these unconscious dynamics affect us on a daily basis, are in fact the core of our identity at some level. And to distinguish between external reality, to also distinguish, and this is critical, between who we are in that developmentally determined unconscious dynamic and what we can learn cognitively, intellectually, after that identity has been established in our infancy and early childhood. So what we learn from experience in the outside world is one thing. It is built upon, according to Freud, the foundational basis of our identity, which remains profoundly unconscious and yet exercises almost moment by moment influence over all of our actions, all of our feelings, and to the point where Freud suggested that it's more powerful in terms of our behaviors and thoughts and feelings and even our belief systems than anything we can intellectually come to grasp merely intellectually about the outside world. So he privileges the unconscious over our ability to learn things externally. This sets up a conflict between, I think, psychoanalysis and cognitive behaviorist theory. We'll get to that later. So, psychic reality versus external reality. The dynamic unconscious and repression. Things get repressed into the unconscious. That's how it's filled. He also describes his developmental theories of mind. He calls one the topographic model, the splitting of conscious, preconscious, and unconscious. We all know consciousness. We now, I think, understand the basics of unconscious processes. When he said preconscious, mostly he means just memory. We can access it, but it's not immediately available to our conscious awareness unless thought about. Unconscious is not accessible easily, if at all, to conscious awareness. That's the whole point of good therapies, to get at that. He was the first thinker to understand the developmental model of the mind, that children don't just grow up, they have to be raised. They aren't just little adults preformed that have to just physically grow up. His developmental, what he called the genetic model, what he meant by that is developmental. He didn't know anything about genetics the way we do today, the chromosomes and genes. We may disagree about how he divided up infantile sexuality into the oral, anal, or phallic stage, the latency phase after the Oedipus complex is resolved, adolescence and adulthood. That was his scheme. We may disagree with that. We may call it different things, but nobody today disagrees with his developmental perspective as a basic matter. It was in 1905 in the Dora case that he discovered the transference. And what he means by that is this tendency we all have to interact with people in the real world now through the lens of that developmental sequence, that we don't react to teachers objectively or scientifically. We react to them through the lens of how we have internalized, introjected, identified with our parental figures. All authority figures in our life are reacted to in some way through the lens of those internalized parental relationships. We transfer those earlier patterns onto our adult relationships. The complication is that often doesn't fit very well, and we end up not reacting in reality in a way that's particularly adaptive when we mistake our feelings for facts. And of course, defense mechanisms, projection, splitting, denial, displacement, all ways that we use to manage anxiety. These become central because early Oedipal development is drenched in anxiety, and children have to learn how to manage it. Okay, with the basic introductory material out of the way, let us turn, in fact, to the play itself. I think most people know the basics, but let me review just to be clear. The Oedipus plays, there were three, about by Sophocles, the Theban plays, named after the city where most of the initial action takes place, concern Oedipus. Oedipus, the child, was born into to the king and queen of Thebes, King Laius and Queen Jocasta. As was common in that era, the baby was taken to the oracle at Delphi to get a vision of what his life might be like. And the oracle gave very disturbing news to the king and queen that their son would grow up to kill the father and marry the mother. This horrified them, and they agreed to kill the child. Not themselves directly, but they did what the Spartans did quite a bit and what was fairly common in Greek civilization at the time. They had a servant take the child out onto a hill and expose it, basically leave it there to die. In addition, they bound the child's ankles. They pierced their ankles and tied them together so it couldn't move at all. How much a 2 or 3 day old baby could move wasn't clear, but that's the story. Oedipus itself means swollen ankle, which you can imagine cutting or poking a hole in a child's ankles would cause them to swell. So the servant takes the child out to the hill to abandon it to death. On the way, coincidentally, he crosses a road and runs into a carriage. That carriage has a servant of the Queen of Corinth in it. Queen of Corinth, being childless with her husband, the King of Corinth, this servant realizes in the face of this baby that, oh, what a wonderful gift for my queen. So she talks the servant into giving the baby to her, and the servant goes back and says, yes, I in fact left the child to die, which he hadn't, of course. So the child is then taken to the Queen of Corinth, who adopts it, claims it to be her own, and Oedipus is raised. The prince of Corinth and everyone believes that he is the natural son of the king and queen of Corinth. At age 18, the young, strapping, strong, heroic prince is taken to the oracle at Delphi to get a vision for what his life's going to be like. And the oracle says, you're going to grow up and kill your father and marry your mother. Oedipus is horrified by that. He loves his mother and father. They've been good to him, raised him well. And he refuses even to go back to Corinth to take any chance that the proclamation will be true, and off he goes. Where does he go? He heads out away from Corinth, and it happens to be on the road to, you guessed it, Thebes. Where, as he gets closer to Thebes, he comes across a chariot or wagon carrying an old man, and his servants, and the old man is very harsh and strikes at him with his staff, orders him off the road. Young Oedipus, prince of Thebes and not used to such rough treatment, fights back, kills the servants, kills the old man, and carries on his journey. The old man, obviously, was the king of Thebes, his father. He approaches Thebes, which is now under the grip of a terrifying sphinx who's got the whole city being held hostage. And the sphinx has agreed to allow the city to be free if and only if a hero will solve the sphinx's riddle. If the hero is correct, the sphinx will go away, freeing the city. If the hero gets it wrong, the hero will be eaten on the spot by the sphinx. Oedipus rises to the challenge, being the noble young warrior that he is, and the sphinx gives the riddle. By now, I think most people have heard this. It's kind of famous. What animal moves on all four legs in the morning, two in the afternoon, and three in the evening? Oedipus grasps the animal as a metaphor for man, and the time frame as a metaphor for life. A child crawls on all fours in the morning, youth, as a man walks on two legs, and as an old man, the evening, with his cane, therefore walks on three. Oedipus thereby breaks the siege of the Sphinx, frees the city, and is of course welcomed into the city by the queen, Jocasta, who recently has lost her husband to some highway incident. She welcomes him in. He's a young strapping hero who saved the city, and of course they're married, fulfilling the double prophecy laid out by the oracle at Delphi, both when he was born and when he turned 18. And the story goes on for quite some time after that. They, in fact, are man and wife for many years, something like 20 years. They have four children together. And at some point, there is a plague on the city, a plague of infertility. And again, the oracle is consulted, and the oracle tells Oedipus and Jocasta that the murderer of Laius, the king, has never been found, and the city is being punished because of that injustice. It has not been righted. The wrong has never been righted. Oedipus immediately realizes his mistake in not tracking down the murderer of the prior king, commits to do so, swears an oath that he will banish the murderer, will catch the murderer and banish him, and the search begins. Now it gets complicated, and this is where I think the bulk of the play takes place, and the bulk of what Freud ended up saying is a parallel between the play and the work of psychoanalysis. It becomes a mystery. Who killed the king? And the little bits of evidence come up, are denied, are disregarded, more evidence is found, and of course, ultimately it comes out that it was Oedipus himself. When it comes out, when it finally comes out and is undeniable, Jocasta, the mother wife, is horrified. In fact, has tried, because of her suspicions, to get Oedipus off this unrelenting path, which he will have none of. I'll come back to that a little later. And she, seeing the full horror of what has happened, hangs herself. Oedipus, realizing also what has happened, finds her, takes the brooches from her cape and plunges the needles into his eyes, blinding himself forever, and banishes himself to wander about a blind seer after that. And subsequently, the two plays involve him and his wanderings. Okay, that is Sophocles, the play, and the myth. It's essential, I think, to understand the centrality of this play to Freud's thinking about psychoanalysis and human development to realize Freud took this play very personally. It's really quite astonishing. There's an entire book by a man named Peter Rudnitsky's Rudnitsky. It's called Freud and Oedipus, Between Life and Myth. And he documents fairly well that Freud had been fascinated by this all the way to back to his undergraduate days, before there was a hint of psychoanalysis, before there was a hint of him even being interested in this field at all. In Freud's subsequent The Interpretation of Dreams, Rudnitsky quotes, during his first public exposition of what would later become known as the Oedipus complex, Freud observes, parenthetically, that the action of Oedipus, the king, depicts, quote, a process that can be likened to the work of a psychoanalysis. And Rudnitsky also comments, in no case is the parallel between the work of psychoanalysis and the action of Sophocles' drama closer than in that of Freud's self-analysis. There is a fascinating incident that occurred in 1906 that Rudnitsky documents. In 1906, on the occasion of his 50th birthday, Freud was presented by a group of adherents with a medallion engraved on one side with his own portrait in profile, and on the other with a design of Oedipus answering the Sphinx, inscribed with a line in Greek from Oedipus the King, who knew the famous riddles and was a man most mighty. When Freud read the inscription, Ernst Jones relates, he became pale and agitated as if he had encountered a revenant, someone who was returned from the dead. And the reason for Freud's agitation was, quote, that as a young student at the University of Vienna, he used to stroll around the great arcaded court inspecting the busts of former famous professors of the institution. He then had the fantasy not merely of seeing his own bust there in the future, which would not have been anything remarkable in an ambitious student, but of it being inscribed with the identical words he now saw on the medallion. An astonishing coincidence. Freud's identification with Oedipus could not have been more complete. And this is the to me, the key. What was Oedipus doing? Oedipus was going after the truth, though the heavens fall. Going after the truth, regardless of the consequences. Going after the truth, regardless of its cost to him personally. And this was an ambition. This was a role model that Freud, I think, took to heart from his earliest college days. And delivered to us in Freud's writing as a challenge. What is the truth? His quest to get at the truth of human development in the human mind and his own mind ought to be our quest. Can we handle the truth? There's the old movie, You Can't Handle the Truth, is a famous line by Jack Nicholson. Well, the first time I heard that, my first response was, well, Jack Nicholson's character was correct. We can't handle the truth very easily or very well or very much of it. But the goal of Oedipus, of Freud, and Freud's challenge to us is to learn more and more about the truth, again, with great courage, though the heavens fall. I want to add a part here that comes from Robert Capers' great book, Building Out into the Dark. He agreed with this formulation, I think, and he quotes Wilfred Bion concerning the importance of truth. Bion's axiom implies that the search for truth is as vital to the mind as the search for food is to the organism. Anything that seriously threatens the search for truth threatens the life of the mind. And I think that's what Freud meant by defense mechanisms. Anytime you're in denial of the truth, because reality evokes in us more anxiety than we can tolerate. We can't handle the truth, hence the defense mechanisms. But then Caper adds a portion of this that I think verges on poetry. He talks about creativity. Creativity is disciplined by observation, and a true creation, artistic or scientific, conveys an observation of some truth purely for the sake of conveying it, not for the sake of using it as propaganda. Observation depends in turn on the creative freedom to see things as they are. And I think directly this is the power given to those who can successfully work through the Oedipus complex and its derivatives. Creativity resides in the part of the personality in which the beauty of the world combines with the courage to engage it, emboldening the ego to create for itself. The intrapsychic exemplar of beauty lies in the child's apprehension of its beautiful mother. Beautiful because she is the source of its life as well as of the psychological containment that helps the child bear the terror of her beauty. The intrapsychic exemplar of courage is the child's apprehension of its father. Courageous because despite his own fears, he risks his safety to shelter and defend her against the dangers that would damage or destroy her. The development of children's creativity depends on their allowing these mysterious parental qualities to combine in a spontaneous, creative intercourse. And that, artistically, poetically, beautifully, represents, I think, Freud's ultimate goal in the development and derivatives of the Oedipus complex. If a child can allow, can take in, identify with both parents, and allow the relationship of the parents, assuming they are healthy, to work within him, if he can then imagine being a third, observing them, taking in their creative intercourse into him, it allows, or her, it allows the creation of a space to observe the outside world, honestly, somewhat objectively. It isn't just a symbiotic oneness with a mother figure pre-Oedipal and therefore inevitably delusional. A baby does not understand the world, cannot understand the world. Developmentally, it's too early. It is the Oedipus complex and the internalization of both parents and the parental relationship that provides for the first time the boy and girl child's ability to imagine relationships which they can observe and from which they themselves are observed as a separate person. It is essential that this development take place because it is only through its development that a sense of independent identity is formed. This is why I believe Freud thought that the resolution of the Oedipus complex was the central developmental event of human life. It is not until it happens that we are truly independent creatures. We are always tied to our relationships. We are not isolating individuals. We are always in relationships. But we are not a whole individual. We are not a separate self in any realistic way, capable of interacting with a separate world and separate people until this process has been successfully accomplished. I think, if I may anticipate a little bit here, that Freud's understanding of therapy was in fact along similar lines. Part and parcel of good therapy is the initiation of a developmental trajectory that would bring Oedipal development back online at whatever stage it was derailed, to complete the effort to become a whole and healthy person, capable of independent, healthy relationships in the real world with real independent people themselves. Okay, by way of preliminary introduction then. Let's go back. Let's begin looking at how Freud's ideas of the Oedipus complex developed. The first published version is found in a letter, October 15th, 1897, very early, to his colleague Flies, who he had carried on an extensive correspondence with for several years. He says, among other things, quote, "I have found in my own case, too, the phenomenon of being in love with my mother and jealous of my father, and I now consider it a universal event in early childhood, even if not so early as in children who have been made hysterical. Similar to the invention of parentage, family romance in paranoia, heroes, founders of religion, if this is so, we can understand the gripping power of Oedipus Rex. In spite of all the objections that reason raises against the presupposition of fate, we can understand why the later drama of fate was bound to fail so miserably. Our feelings rise against any arbitrary individual compulsion, such as is supposed in, he cites a later play, and the like. But the Greek legend seizes upon a compulsion which everyone recognizes because he senses its existence within himself. This, he's describing here the power that this play still has 2,500 years after it was written. It evokes something in us still. Everyone in the audience was once a budding Oedipus in fantasy, and each recoils in horror from the dream fulfillment here transplanted into reality with the full quantity of repression which separates his infantile state from his present one. So, almost before he had finally formulated the basics of psychoanalysis, Freud understood the fundamentals of the Oedipus myth's direct implication in childhood and adult development. Interestingly, he goes on to correlate that same dynamic in the Shakespeare play Hamlet. I will come back to this later and go through the details of Hamlet as he treats it later. Suffice to say that he draws a parallel between those two. And if Hamlet, generally considered by critics to be the greatest play in Western civilization, it's an astonishing coincidence, of course, it's not a coincidence, to Freud at least, that the play considered the greatest play in Western civilization has themes virtually identical to what Aristotle considered the greatest play of antiquity, Sophocles' Oedipus. We'll come back to this later. It's absolutely fascinating, and also part of, I think, the what makes Freud interesting as a detective novel. Okay. His next treatment was from The Interpretation of Dreams, published in 1900, actually published in 1899, but he wanted it in the new century, so they gave it a 1900 publication date. He says, page 260, all of my references are to the standard edition of the complete psychological works of Sigmund Freud. In my experience, which is already extensive, the chief part in the mental lives of all children who later become psychoneurotics is played by their parents. Well, this was written in 1900, a little bit before that. This idea, though now generally accepted as the core of developmental psychology, has actually in the last 20 years gotten some very direct confirmation from developmental neuroscience. The amazing bodies of data generated by neurological scanning technologies have in some very direct ways at the neurological level confirmed that this is true. An astonishing scientific confirmation of, I think, what is Freud's just intuitive genius. Being in love with one parent and hating the other are among the essential constituents of the stock of psychical impulses which is formed at that time and which is of such importance in determining the symptoms of later neurosis. And this is the part that really jumped out at me the first time I read it. It is not my belief, however, that psychoneurotics differ sharply in this respect from other human beings who remain normal, that they are able, that is, to create something absolutely new and peculiar to themselves. He's saying they can't do that. It is far more probable, and this is confirmed by occasional observations on normal children, that they are only distinguished by exhibiting on a magnified scale feelings of love and hatred to their parents which occur less obviously and less intensely in the minds of most children. And this is the part that immediately distinguishes Freud from all other psychiatrists and psychologists in Europe at that time. This was the first indication that I have been able to find of any psychiatrist, psychologist, anywhere near this era, declaring that mental illness and mental health were really not that far apart. That up until now, virtually all of psychiatry had the running assumption that anyone who is significantly mentally ill was fundamentally different, fundamentally corrupt, fundamentally probably brain damaged in ways completely unrelated to the healthy, normal rest of us. Freud's the first one, and again, virtually all subsequent research suggests that he is correct here, that there's something of his innate humanism here, that there but for the grace of God go I, there but for the random luck of the draw in terms of who my parents were, go I. I think it is worth noting, and something that I don't think is commented on enough. He may have been wrong in many ways, but his fundamental humanism shines through in his treatment of his patients and in a kind and understanding attitude toward people generally. A tragic attitude. He understood that people are often quite flawed, that we are not susceptible to perfection, that we are all creatures with feet of clay, to use another biblical reference, which he was fond of. And I think that that's worth stopping and pondering for a moment. So in The Interpretation of Dreams, he again goes through the details of the play, and slightly more specifically, and this is what I want to point out, given the sort of chaotic unfolding of his theory, I want you to notice, though I will repeat myself, I will repeat him. Every time I do, I think what you'll see is a slight variation on the theme. He will add something to what he said before in language that's very similar but not identical. And it's in those subtle changes, that sometimes not so subtle changes in theory, changes in perspective happen. So attention to detail here is essential. So he goes on, the action of the play consists in nothing other than the process of revealing, with cunning delays and ever-mounting excitement, a process that can be likened to the work of a psychoanalysis, similar to his letter to Fleece two or three years before. That Oedipus himself is the murderer of Laius, the king, but further that he is the son of the murdered man and of Jocasta. Appalled by the abomination which he has unwittingly perpetrated, Oedipus blinds himself and forsakes his home. The oracle has been fulfilled. All right, and he goes on, and again, to describe why this moves an audience to this day, why it moved the Greeks. He denies that there's some conflict between the will of the gods and the will of men, and denies really that its power, the power of the play, comes from this play of destiny, conflicting destiny and fate. What he believes is the abiding power of the play is this, Oedipus' destiny. His destiny moves us only because it might have been ours, because the oracle laid the same curse upon us before our birth as upon him. It is the fate of all of us, perhaps, to direct our first sexual impulse towards our mother and our first hatred and our first murderous wish against our father. He's talking here entirely about young boys. Of course, we'll get to girls in a little bit. Quote, our dreams convince us that it is so. King Oedipus, who slew his father, Laius, and married his mother, Jocasta, merely shows us the fulfillment of his own childhood wishes. But, more fortunate than he, we have meanwhile succeeded, insofar as we have not become psychoneurotics, in detaching our sexual impulses from our mothers and forgetting our jealousy of our fathers. Here is one in whom these primeval wishes of our own childhood have been fulfilled. We shrink back from him with the whole force of the repression by which those wishes have since that time been held down within us. While the poet, as he unravels the past, brings to light the guilt of Oedipus, he is at the same time compelling us to recognize our own inner minds, in which those same impulses, though suppressed, are still to be found. Right. The contrast with which the closing chorus leaves us confronted. The chorus, fix on Oedipus your eyes, who resolve the dark enigma, noblest champion and most wise. Like a star, his envied fortune mounted, beaming far and wide. Now he sinks in seas of anguish, whelmed beneath a raging tide. Freud says that strikes us as a warning at ourselves and our pride, at us who since our childhood have grown so wise and so mighty in our own eyes. we do seem to be awfully convinced that we know the truth, when perhaps we are little more than delusional about so many things we believe. What Freud is suggesting here is that belief systems flow from character structure, that what we believe is not the result of a cost-benefit analysis objectively accomplished scientifically about the outside world and the facts or the truth, but really our belief systems are called forth by our own internal contradictions, our own derailed development. We believe what our character and our development drives us to believe, and are blind to the truth more often than not. Like Oedipus, we live in ignorance of these wishes, repugnant to morality, which have been forced upon us by nature, and after their revelation, we may all of us well seek to close our eyes to the scenes of our childhood. And the implication is, close our eyes to reality because we can't handle the truth. This, I think, ultimately is what he called resistance. He is also painfully aware that this entire subject causes people no end of discomfort. And he's just explained why, but he does address this in a footnote. Quote, none of the findings of psychoanalytic research has provoked such embittered denial, such fierce opposition, or such amusing contortions on the part of critics as this indication of the childhood impulses toward incest which persist in the unconscious. And he's right about that. Even at this early stage, he had already been attacked just relentlessly about the whole idea of infantile sexuality, and never more aggressively than around this particular question. He adds this in the middle of the footnote, though. Later studies have shown that the Oedipus complex, which was touched upon for the first time in the above paragraphs in the interpretation of dreams, throws a light of undreamt of importance on the history of the human race and on the evolution of religion and morality. So he is now bracketing the early historical evolution of mankind generally, the individual development, the ontology of individuals, versus the phylogenetic development of the race, but also, at the other end, the development of those things highest in our civilization and culture. Law, religion, morality, ethics. These he is laying at the foot of a healthy, resolved Oedipus complex. More on this later. He's giving hints here as to the scope of why he thinks the Oedipus complex is so profoundly important. And he notices resistance to his ideas. He notices resistance to Oedipus's ideas, even in Jocasta, Oedipus's mother. He cites a short quote from her speech as this knowledge is becoming more and more clear, but before the final realization. Jocasta says to Oedipus, many a man ere now in dreams hath lain with her who bare him. He hath least annoy, who with such omens trouble not his mind. Basically, she says, yeah, guys dream about sleeping with their mothers all the time. That's just dreams. Don't pay any attention to that. Put that out of your thought process. It's just dreams. Everybody has them. It's almost funny. Question. Sophocles could not have had her speak those lines if most of the audience wouldn't sort of nod their head and go, yeah, I've had that dream before myself. Yeah, okay, that makes sense. It's kind of scary. Don't like it. But yeah, he couldn't have just made that up. It must have been a common social experience. And it remains so to this day. Psychoanalysis sees in dream interpretations over and over some direct and plenty of indirect indications of an Oedipal dynamic. Let me touch just once on the subsequent evaluation that Freud made on Hamlet. because Hamlet is such a unique play, without much disagreement in critics, at least that I have read, Hamlet is at the center of the Western canon, the most important play in Western civilization. I have heard more than one respected critic say that. It isn't clear who the runner-up would be or who or what play might challenge Hamlet's centrality. But listen to the way Shakespeare evaluates the power of Hamlet's abiding importance to us. It is being played to this day all over the world. Another of the great creations of tragic poetry, Shakespeare's Hamlet, has its roots in the same soil as Oedipus. But the changed treatment of the same material reveals the whole difference in the mental life of these two widely separated epochs of civilization, the secular advance of repression in the emotional life of mankind. In the Oedipus, the child's wishful fantasy that underlies it is brought into the open and realized as it would be in a dream. In Hamlet, it remains repressed. And just as in the case of a neurosis, we only learn of its existence from its inhibiting consequences. Strangely enough, the overwhelming effect produced by the more modern tragedy has turned out to be compatible with the fact that people have remained completely in the dark as to the hero's character. The play is built up on Hamlet's hesitation over fulfilling the task of revenge that is assigned to him, but its text offers no reasons or motives for these hesitations, and an immense variety of attempts at interpreting them have failed to produce a result. According to the view, which was originated by Goethe and is still the prevailing one today, Hamlet represents the type of man whose power of direct action is paralyzed by an excessive development of his intellect. He is, quote, sicklied o'er with the pale cast of thought, unquote. According to another view, the dramatist has tried to portray a pathologically irresolute character, which might be classed as neuroaesthetic. The plot of the drama shows us, however, that Hamlet is far from being represented as a person incapable of taking any action. He is seen doing so on two occasions, first in a sudden outburst of temper when he runs his sword through the eavesdropper behind the arras, and secondly in a premeditated and even crafty fashion when, with all the callousness of a Renaissance prince, he sends the two courtiers to the death that they had planned for himself. Here it is. What is it, then, that inhibits him in fulfilling the task set him by his father's ghost? The answer, once again, is that it is the peculiar nature of the task. Hamlet is able to do anything except take vengeance on the man who did away with his father and took that father's place with his mother, the man who shows him the repressed wishes of his own childhood realized. Thus, the loathing which should drive him on to revenge is replaced in him by self-reproaches, by scruples of conscience, which remind him that he himself is literally no better than the sinner whom he is to punish. And I do not believe that anyone has ever come up with a more compelling, profound, insightful explanation for the drama of Hamlet and the meaning of the flow of the entire play. It's astonishing. I hesitate to take it to the next level here, but I must. What are the modern treatments of this subject, if there are any? If it's true that there was an Oedipal dynamic in Sophocles' Oedipus Rex, if it's true that Hamlet touched on these same subjects so profoundly, has no one touched on this subject in the modern era? And I was, I have to confess, I was watching the HBO special Sons of Anarchy. Don't know if anyone out there listening to this has watched that series, but I was floored. I was flabbergasted after watching the entire series. It struck me what the connection was. What is the core of the story? We have Jax Teller, his mother Gemma, his deceased father John, and the father's best friend, who kills him and marries the mother. Now, it's not the brother as in Hamlet, and it's, but it, the tension in Sons of Anarchy seems to me to be substantially around Jax trying to discover exactly how his father was killed, the slow mounting evidence that it was in fact not just a motorcycle accident, but an actual arranged murder completed by the man, his own best friend, the father's best friend, who subsequently then marries the mother. And Jack's season after season slowly evolves evidence that that is the truth. He is now faced with a man who murdered his father and married his mother. And it takes season after season for him to be able to finally do something about it. The hesitation makes no sense. He had the proof and could yet do nothing about it in a way that seems quite parallel to Hamlet and Sophocles' Oedipus. Now, I am not putting Sons of Anarchy in the same category. What I am pointing out is that there is this abiding theme that is going to, if we look closely, perhaps be repeated in other artistic creations. I couldn't resist throwing that out. It seemed quite obvious to me. Okay, let us move forward. We go from the 1900 interpretation of dreams to the 1905 three essays on sexuality. Freud makes a leap from child psychosexual development into puberty. And this is one thing that I have always sort of vaguely been aware of, but it wasn't clear to me until I reread this material carefully. Freud uses the phrase diphasic sexual development, and I wasn't clear what that was. Well, there's the early Oedipus complex proper in childhood, which Freud comes to believe very closely approximates adolescent and adult sexual development. It is inhibited in its aim, but it is all but completed with the repression necessary at the resolution of the Oedipus complex. It goes into a latency phase. That overt sexual dynamic becomes repressed, and children enter the latency period from ages approximately 5 until puberty at age 10, 11, 12. And then the eruption in puberty and early adolescence of the full somatic effects of the developed sexuality and the reawakening of directly Oedipal dynamics Freud discusses here. He talks about how adolescence sexual fantasies will inevitably recreate the Oedipal fantasies long repressed in their own childhoods and reawaken the object love that was laid down and repressed into the unconscious. Again, an example of how powerful the unconscious remains. It controls us from the unconscious. Our source, our choice of object is not neutral, is not objective. We don't fall in love randomly or accidentally. There's no such thing as love at first sight. Love at first sight is when the evocation of Oedipal repressed developmental desires get projected onto our target. It is not love at first sight. It is love at the sight of a woman who remarkably reminds us of our mothers, is what Freud was discussing here. This is where, on page 226, the nuclear complex quote was taken initially. All right. He says, in these fantasies, the infantile tendencies invariably emerge once more, but this time with intensified pressure from somatic sources. The biology of adolescence kicks in with extra weight. Among these tendencies, the first place is taken with uniform frequency by the child's sexual impulses towards his parents, which are, as a rule, already differentiated owing to the attraction of the opposite sex, the son being drawn toward his mother and the daughter toward his father. at the same time as these plainly incestuous fantasies are overcome and repudiated, one of the most significant, but also one of the most painful, psychical achievements of the pubertal period is completed. Detachment from parental authority, a process that alone makes possible the opposition, which is so important for the progress of civilization, between new generation and old. This is where Freud lays down the civilizational component of the Oedipus derivatives in adolescence. The focus of adolescent development at this stage is the final repression of Oedipal desires, the breaking free of, the repression of, not breaking free of, the direct sexual connection to parents, the direct hostile connection to parents in the acting out of Oedipal dynamics directly, the identification with the father that resolves the Oedipal complex in the boy, and the change of, not change of object, but change of focus away from the mother into a mother substitute, a young woman who remarkably, or not so remarkably, virtually always has the attributes of the mother herself. It is that, those derivatives that comprise the achievement of adolescent development into a separate, independent, autonomous adulthood. And it is that connection, the derivatives of the parents to the adolescent, that provides the glue within which a civilization can thrive. If this chain is broken, if the identification with the parents is not sufficiently achieved across a civilization, then we end up with a rapidly deteriorating culture. We do not identify with each other. Social bounds, social binding, bonding, is a direct derivative of this developmental sequelae. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. He says, at every stage in the course of development through which all human beings ought by rights to pass, a certain number are held back. So there are some who have never got over their parents' authority and have withdrawn their affection from them, either very incompletely or not at all. So he is suggesting, again directly, that neuroses, mental illness of any type, ultimately finds its source in derailed Oedipal development. If we don't get this right, we are left neurotic to one degree or another. The closer one comes to the deeper disturbances of psychosexual development, the more unmistakably the importance of incestuous object choice emerges. All right. There can be no doubt that every object choice, whatever, is based, though less closely, on these prototypes. A man especially looks for someone who can represent his picture of his mother, as it has dominated his mind from his earliest childhood. In view of the importance of a child's relations to his parents in determining his later choice of sexual object, it can easily be understood that any disturbance of those relations will produce the gravest effects upon his adult sexual life. This is key. This is profound. Jealousy in a lover is never without an infantile root, or at least an infantile reinforcement. If there are quarrels between the parents, or if their marriage is unhappy, the ground will be prepared in their children for the severest predisposition to a disturbance of sexual development or to neurotic illness. What are you suggesting here? And I think this is the core. This is the absolute core of, at an unconscious level, why Freud has been attacked so viciously in the modern era. Because he is offending us. He is stating in the clearest possible terms that children's mental health depends on the successful resolution of the Oedipal complex, which he is suggesting directly cannot be done if the parents aren't emotionally healthy and together. You cannot be a good parent if you don't have a healthy sex life. You can't be a good parent if you aren't in a stable, monogamous, committed relationship. And because, he's suggesting here, the child is literally identifying with that loving couple and internalizes that healthy couple and each individual in that couple. And it is that internalization, that identification, that forms the bedrock of his own healthy identity. Without it, it doesn't work. And what we have today, tragically, it appears, is the utter, if not utter, substantial destruction of the nuclear family, and children of divorce, single parenting, and the abandonment of much parenting to daycare centers and babysitters. And it is not surprising that psychotherapists across the board have noted repeatedly the dramatic and consistent increase in severe mental illnesses going back 20 or 30 or 40 years. We see a correlation, at the very least a correlation, between the destruction of the nuclear family and the increased severity of mental illnesses across the board. Freud would say this is no accident. It is a direct derivative of our failure as a culture to maintain the developmentally necessary family life that every child needs to grow up healthy. Now, I got to be clear here, having offended probably half of my audience. Freud will subsequently recognize that this is a kind of archetype, that this is a primary way of thinking. This is the not just the skeleton, but the core of development. He will acknowledge over and over the complexity of human emotional development. He will acknowledge multiple routes toward health. He is not being dogmatic with this. I am probably being more dogmatic about it than Freud was. But I think at a core level, that's what he's trying to get at. And I think it bears, at the very least, it bears some serious consideration. And he goes on, a child's affection for his parents is no doubt the most important infantile trait, which after being revived at puberty points the way to his choice of an object. But it is not the only one. Okay, he's being a little creative here. Other starting points with the same early origin enable a man to develop more than one sexual line based no less upon his childhood and to lay down very various conditions for his object choice. Again, we've got some variations here. He's trying to be creative. He's staying open to alternative paths of development. He drops a footnote at this point. The innumerable peculiarities of the erotic life of human beings, as well as the compulsive character of the process of falling in love itself, are quite unintelligible except by reference back to childhood and as being residual effects of childhood. He wants to reinforce, however varied that development might be, the developmental perspective that we cannot heal mental illness as adults if we do not become clear about their source in infantile and early childhood developmental derailments. If you don't know how it got broke, you can't fix it. This is one of the most profound, I think, advantages to psychoanalytic thinking, as opposed to cognitive behaviorism, existential thought, which privileges thought patterns. If it is true, or to whatever extent this is true, that mental illness has its core in early developmental derailment, then understanding how that happened is the central function of good therapy. We disregard this at some risk to our therapeutic success. Let me address briefly some of the early hints Freud laid out concerning development of heterosexual versus homosexual orientation. He addresses it repeatedly throughout his writings. And I have to say, he addresses it in a way that seems shockingly modern. Freud not only was ahead of his era in terms of recognizing infantile sexuality, he was decades ahead of his crowd on understanding the profound complexity of homosexual object choice. And his position on that I think, if read carefully, is going to be hard to argue with using any modern theory. A couple, but we'll get to that. So, as by way of introduction, it may be presumed, in the next place, that in the case of men, a childhood recollection of the affection shown them by their mother and others of the female sex who looked after them when they were children contributes powerfully to directing their choice toward women. Okay, no big shock there. On the other hand, their early experience of being deterred by their father from sexual activity and their competitive relation to him deflect them from their own sex. Both of these two factors apply equally to girls, whose sexual activity is particularly subject to the watchful guardianship of their mother. They thus acquire a hostile relation to their own sex, which influences their object choice decisively in what is regarded as the normal direction. The education of boys by male persons, by slaves in antiquity, seems to encourage homosexuality. The frequency of inversion, what he called homosexuality, among the present-day aristocracy is made somewhat more intelligible by their employment of men servants, as well as by the fact that their mothers give less personal care to their children. In the case of some hysterics, it is found that the early loss of one of their parents, whether by death, divorce, or separation, with the result that the remaining parent absorbs the whole of the child's love, determines the sex of the person who is later to be chosen as a sexual object, and may thus open the way to permanent inversion. I hope he was clear about what he's saying here. What I think he is saying quite directly is that though, and we'll get to the details of this a little bit later, there is a bedrock biological bisexual predisposition in all humans, male and female. That, to him, was bedrock. That we are not naturally heterosexual or homosexual. We are both from jump. This, to him, is bedrock human nature. And that bedrock biological bisexuality then depends on nurturing, then depends on the vagaries of development to determine whether an individual becomes heterosexual or homosexual. He lays out the common way, the way that he says is considered normal, and the way most people are raised and the dynamics of that process tend toward a heterosexual orientation. But he is suggesting here that it isn't always so, nor need be, that there is a normal homosexual development that can be understood as one of the variants of Oedipal development, one of the complexities of Oedipus development. He is, for the first time, and again, the first time in all of European medical history, suggesting that homosexuality is not a mental illness, which, after he died in 38, the American Psychoanalytic Association went back to a pre-Freudian understanding of homosexuality, considered it a mental illness, and supported the continuing criminalization of homosexuality. It wasn't until 1972 that the American Psychoanalytical Association finally went back to Freud's understanding that homosexuality is simply one of several possible developmental derivatives. So this to me is an astonishing thing that literally, near 80 years after Freud laid down this understanding of homosexuality, the American Psychoanalytic Association finally catches up to that. And we chastise Freud for his retrograde attitudes towards sexuality. He was ahead of us all for 80 years, it seems. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. In this treatment, he very clearly suggests that boys and girls have a parallel psychosexual development, that there is a neat sort of parallelism between the boy and the girl's psychosexual development. The boy gravitates toward the mother, is in a hostile relationship with the father. The girl becomes hostile with the mother, wants daddy all to herself. There's enough of this going around, enough people see this if they have eyes to see, that I don't think anyone argues with that, at least in general terms. So, With that, let's take a short break. I will move after this to five lectures on psychoanalysis. We're now at 1910. Some interesting variations happen from now on. Let's take a short break. Come back in a moment. Thank you.